Welcome to the Behind the Racket Pod, the podcast taking you behind the racket with today's top tennis players and biggest issues facing the sport.
Behind the Racket is a community to give fans and players in the world of tennis the opportunity to open up like they have never done before.
Visit BehindTheRacket.com for the latest stories, merch, as well as direct links to all of the latest podcasts. It can also be found on iTunes, Google Play, Pandora, Stitcher, and wherever you find your podcasts. Download the episodes and make sure to leave a review.
And we want you to be a part of the conversation. Find me at NoahRubin33 or Mike at MikeCTennis on all forms of social media. You can also learn more at BehindTheRacket.com or MikeCTennis.com.
Special thanks to my sponsor, New Balance. Visit their latest shoes and styles at NewBalance.com and learn more about their program of giving back at hashtag NBGivesBack.
You can also help support the podcast by visiting patreon.com/BehindTheRacketPod and receive rewards from our travels around the world. And now.
Okay, let's do this.
I already have. In my head, it's been started for the last 45 minutes, Noah. And welcome back from the honeymoon, big fella. Let's talk about your time in India and the Maldives. Listen, it was a great wedding.
Thank you. One great video of you that, you know, just, it makes me smile. It makes me smile. You were... What?
Which video was that?
It was a little dance.
Have I seen this video?
It was a little Cajun dance in there. You know, you started a little slow at the rehearsal dinner. You were a little tired from your Miami stay. It was a great round for you, but...
No sleep for like 48 hours.
You came out hot. You came out hot in the third period. You know, the Saturday night Mike-cation was a special occurrence. Mm. And
it's amazing what happens when you haven't had any drinks for like months, and then like you have like three espresso martinis and raring to go.
Pretty good though. They were fine.
They were pretty good. So I realized afterwards, and I don't remember if I talked to you about this. That was my first Jewish wedding.
Interesting.
I am 83 years old, and it's my first ever Jewish wedding.
And I feel like in your life, you're fairly diverse, even though, you know, you hate everybody. You also are fairly diverse. Mm. So it would be, you would think one would just fly by in your
life. Like one sneak in there that I just didn't know about or something. But
I will say, ironically, we had more than a few people that, we had a couple young that like have never been to a wedding, and then be definitely like a Jewish wedding. Like Maloney had no idea what it entailed. He's like, am I just flying out for like, I'm like, we just have like a half hour service and we go home and that's it. And he's like, I'm flying out for that. Yeah.
So here's the question I did need to ask on the podcast. Because I was a little perplexed by the eating situation afterwards.
A lot.
Because so you know, the ceremony was at what, 7:30? Ended up being around, right around that time. So then there was a 2 hour cocktail hour.
If you're not full,
that was 2 hours.
If you're not full,
hold on, I'm not done. Let me describe this is not everybody who listens to this podcast was there, Noah. Let me explain what happened first.
No, of course, please.
7:30 ceremony, do the ceremony. 2 hours of a cocktail bar hour plus in this 2 hours, full buffet, the entire buffet, everything was, you could eat for like the entire 2 hours and have had like four meals.
Yeah.
Huge buffet.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm going into Seinfeld right now, but I am.
I was just gonna say,
what's the deal with the cocktail hour? Then after that, then we go upstairs. And so I'm walking up the stairs with Loeb. Jamie Loeb was there. Yeah. And we're going up the stairs and I'm just like, cool. So now we dance for a little while. We get up there. Then there's a full seated meal. I'm getting a filet at 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, it was like 10:30, a nice little filet. And then we had pizza, McDonald's, Taco Bell, and candy at a food truck at 12:30. It was, the cocktail hour, what you have to know at a Jewish wedding done right, you want to feel like shit come dinner. And then you're hopefully you have enough drinks in you and you dance enough that you can go rally, repeat, and kind of get in there again. But like, if you're not full after the cocktail hour, we've done something wrong. Like that is a poor effort at the cocktail hour. So yeah, we had like, I don't know, it was like 8 stations at the cocktail hour. Yeah, it was aggressive.
And I think more than anything, this was on me for not being properly prepared. It's like you guys as tennis players, really. I mean, you have to properly prepare for the match that's in front of you.
Dynamic.
And I just didn't prepare for the match that was in front of me. I thought it was just going to be, you know, ceremony, eat your dinner, then you dance. And then all of a sudden everything got, you know, taken out of context, and I'm lost. I was lost.
Yeah, no, you look like a chicken without a head for a little while.
Very, that's a normal Saturday night. a very, very confusing. All kidding aside, it was beautiful. I'm happy that somebody has accepted you for once in your life. And
did you enjoy the wedding more, or Zach Mitchell playing tennis in the morning of the wedding better? Which did you enjoy?
Pretend. I blacked out the morning component of what happened. You congratulations.
Thanks.
Well deserved. Yeah. You guys are pretty.
Be miserable forever. And...
Yeah, we know. You are in Louisiana as we record this. For a little money tournament.
Yeah, I got actually a call from Luke Jensen. And got connected to this guy named Meyer here at in Lake Charles, beautiful little town here. Actually, I've never, weirdly, I don't know if you have you ever been to Louisiana before? I've never done like any of the Mardi Gras stuff or so this is my first time here. I wish I had more time to kind of get out there. But yeah, I mean, super nice. Everybody is like beyond friendly, like it's scaring the shit out of me friendly. I told him last night while I was at my first crawfish boil and arrows into the lake and fishing at midnight, that I'm waiting for somebody to like kill me or do something, or because they are so nice that it's like, but they're like truly like welcoming, like, and willing to help.
Listen, the people of Louisiana, it can be a scary areas. I worked with some people from Louisiana for a long period of time over the last 10 years. And every once in a while, there's just some things that come out of mouths that you're just like, I'm sorry, what? Excuse me?
I was talking, I got a text from Klon, just, you know, catching up, seeing, you know, what I'm up to in my life. And, I was actually talking about kind of these events, these kind of prize money events that are exos and pro-ams and all of that. And honestly, I think, you know, because Mike, I'm such a people person, you know, people love me. When they look at me, they're like, we have more of that. I like,
when has that happened in your life? Go on.
I really do like, I love these events. I really do. Like, even, you know, it doesn't necessarily always fulfill like the competitor in me, but like the outreach, the being with kids, and like some of these guys coming up and saying, oh, this was such an amazing, like if it's Stefan and I playing in EXO, like, and then we play a pro-am with them. And like, I say, that's like the best, you know, most fun they ever had in a tennis court in the past year. And like, you know, this is like one of these events, these kind of events are the way that you can actually connect to people. And I feel like it doesn't, I think golf does a really good job at tournaments. They always make sure they have a pro-am and stuff like that. I just think tennis does a horrendous job at connecting to the fans, especially at tournaments throughout. I know we talked about it, like how to get challengers more involved in the community and stuff like that. And I think you could take kind of a playbook out of these like little EXO prize money tournaments that really want to connect in some way.
Fully agree. Yeah. I am one of those people, Noah, that I think there should be hard rules. If you're receiving a wild card into a challenger or better event, you are required, and I mean it, required to show up for certain pro-am school, go speak to a school, like, listen, understand there's a schedule that has to be maintained so you can compete at the highest level. But if you get a wild card into our event, here are three things that you are required to do. And I have no problem with that. And I think it should be a mandatory thing.
You know more about golf than I do. Isn't it like required by everybody in the tournament, like, to play this pro-am? Like, how does
No, it's not. No, I will not pretend that I know the intricacies of a professional event like that. Yeah. No, but it's.
I thought like most of these events, like, yeah, you have an X amount of guys that are doing the pro-am and have to do a pro-am every tournament. There's something to that extent.
But I think there's also a pay component to that.
Might be. There might be.
You know, so I think there's something, you know, it's just like, yeah, you'll get X amount to do.
I mean, I always thought, I mean, we bring up the physicality of tennis and you said being ready for the event, but why does it always feel like what's good for the player is bad for the fan and vice versa? I don't know. I always feel like this kind of competition between that where you can never make both of them happy at the same time.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
That's a great question. Yeah. I don't have a good answer for that because I think I have been thinking a lot about the, you know, especially as, and this is one of our big topics of the day, the fact that there are obviously some pretty big impending changes coming to the tours. Yeah. How do we make it so that there is more ability to have those interactions so that there is growth?
I guess in the end, and this is probably one of the largest issues in tennis as a whole is scheduling. I mean, we just made a joke. You were bringing up the fact that there was thought to bring in a Masters 1000 event prior to the Australian Open. And we talk about how long the schedule is. And you made a joke that, okay, well, let's just get rid of off season. Why do we need the 2.5 days of off season anyway? And I think that's kind of what is so difficult because tournaments are so long, so grueling physically and mentally that, you know, to think for a player to give up a night or an afternoon to hit, even though they might want to help, you know, with kids, it's so tough. Or a week, you know, and there's just not enough time. There's not enough time and people are exhausted. But
especially at a 1 week event, at a 2 week event where you have some guaranteed days off. So I was just in Miami, and Miami, they always have the day before the tournament begins, they will have some seeds who go out and do some community events, right? Large city. So you certainly have some charities that you can get involved in. That component is great. And it's fantastic when you have that 2 week event, there's that ability to have a little bit of space. But when you're looking at a week,
there's just not enough time throughout a year also. I mean, it's, you know, whether it's the day during a tournament, whether it's a week during a year, like, you have downtime, you take your downtime because there's none of it. And you can't sacrifice rest. You can't sacrifice a potential training block, you know, that somebody may need. And, you know, I think that's, you know, I was talking to the guys that are putting this on and they're looking to kind of expand this to a different idea kind of the following years. They're like, you know, we talked to a few players that we know, some of the top ones, and they just can't plan and they don't have time and we can't make it work. And I was like, yeah, I mean, there is no answer to that. So I feel like the community misses out. The fans miss out after a while.
Fully agreed.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about this whole restructuring of the calendar, because there's been a lot of talk that as things are getting underway in Madrid right now, that it's going to be announced here that there will be a 10th Masters event somewhere in the Middle East, you know, in the lead up to the Australian Open, which has always been such a crucial part, you know, Brisbane and Sydney and all of those events in Australia leading into the Australian Open, now potentially a Masters event to start the year. Let's talk about it from a player's perspective. What that would mean, how you would see that actually unfolding if, say, 2-3 weeks before the Australian Open, there's suddenly a Masters right at the literally at the beginning of the year.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've never... I always did well at the beginning of the year, but I never played as somebody that was 30 in the world. So tough to say from kind of that point of view of somebody that's, you know, looking to play the top end, they're getting, you know, buys or seated at these events. But yeah, I mean, we're already leaving. day before Christmas is kind of around the same time that we're leaving every year. And that, even though I love going to Aussie and have great memories there, like, you're a little depressed. Like, there's a little bit of like, this is early, I'm missing family occasions, you know. Yeah. And then you get there and you're okay, you settle in, you're like, okay, I love Australia, this is great. So the number one thing is like, where is the Masters 1000 going to be, I think is a really, you know, a big topic of discussion. But also, yeah, the mental preparation that like the second event could be a Masters 1000. I mean, it doesn't feel like it allows the fans or the players time to get into like the state of mind of like, oh, we're ready. And I think that's like telling, it's funny, I was speaking about other sports and how, you know, sports, they start with the preseason, they go into their season, and then you have the playoffs and the championships. And it's like with tennis, even as it is right now, like you start the season and you're in one of the largest tournaments in the world. One of the four biggest tournaments we have is just a few weeks into the beginning of the year, beginning of the season. I think it's such a weird idea for a lot of fans and other sports to be like, wait, that tournament matters as much as the US Open in the final? I was like, yeah, it does. And it's just the start of it. I think that's...
This is the thing we're getting at, though, is like, you're looking at the potential here with this restructuring that's being discussed of it being 14 events. Like, that's the tour. Yeah. 14 events. 10 Masters, 4 Slams, and nothing else.
I think the idea behind it can lead. I mean, and you and I have always spoken about the fact that for tennis to get to where you and I kind of envision some of the changes being, there needs to be some real true restructuring. I think there has to be some real statements that are painful to hear for a lot of players as well, where it's like, hey, this is, yep, you know, we've tried to make everybody happy and nobody happy at the same time for a long time. And I think this is what has to happen. This is how many players can make a living playing the sport. This is how many, you know, all of those kind of conversations. So, you know, the idea behind a restructuring makes sense. I think we've seen a lot of breaking news over the past 6 months that lead us to believe that we're going down a certain path that may not be the right path for tennis, and you know, getting into bed with certain conversations and what that looks like. But yeah, I mean, this calendar has to look different in order for fans to follow easier, in order for players to feel better throughout a year. I just don't know if what we're doing right now is that answer, of course, but yeah.
Yeah. I, you and I have talked about, what we love about the sport. And the one thing I have always kind of hit on, Noah, is opportunity. The fact that at any time you have the opportunity to make things, you know, you and I were just joking about a player who said to you recently that they're one tournament away from being top 50. And, you know, that's a little bit of hyperbole, but that's what I think has always been the beauty. If you get hot, you have that ability to theoretically move from 150, 200, 250, and literally have that ability to change your life because of the fact that you are playing some great tennis. You're moving. And I think there's, you know, for the big picture and drawing in new fans, I think having a much more organized and thoughtful calendar makes a lot of sense. I get very concerned about that capacity for there to be just really good movement for players. I am very concerned about the fact that the player who is 90 in the world, if there's only 14 tournaments, they're going to lose first round in probably 12 of those because they're up against a top 10 or top 20 player, you know, fairly often. And so somebody who's 90 is not going to have the opportunity to win a 250, you know, have that kind of opportunity in front of them. And then the next year they're suddenly back to whatever the challengers are in this new restructured tennis. That is the part that I think is really disconcerting because, you know, I think F1 is the model that a lot of people are kind of pointing at. There's not 100 players there.
You have 20 drivers.
You know what I mean? You could certainly say golf, but there in golf, there's 30, 40, 50 tournaments, right? You go to 14. It's great because those top 20 players are going to be in the final rounds you know, every single time there's a tennis tournament. That's awesome for a very casual fan. For so many players outside of the top 50, it's just going to be like, okay, you get to play two matches this week and you have no opportunity to potentially play third, fourth, fifth matches in a week. I mean, you do have the opportunity. Don't get me wrong. Like if you have a good fortnight in Saudi Arabia, kudos. But the 250s are really important to just allow, you know, you can talk about it, how important it is to have matches under your belt and just kind of build momentum. And that will be gone for players outside of the top 20, I think.
I think we kind of have to start having the conversation of what makes the most sense to lose out on. You know, it's not going to be.
Yeah, perfect. Right.
Like, you know, are we going to lose out on the potential of a player breaking through 1 week and being that great story that we love to hear? That may be worth losing out on in order to have a stable system, salary, X, Y, and Z. I don't know, but sure. You know, we talk about, you know, F1 is obviously one that's brought up. I do like the idea in F1 that you can compete as an individual on a team. I think tennis, I've talked to some people about this, having kind of teams within tennis, I think could make some of the processes easier while you can also compete as an individual. Sure. But I also spoke about the idea of just, you know, like a Premier League where you have relegation, you know, you have promotion, you have, you know, X amount of players are getting relegated and promoted every year, and where you're, whatever division that you're in that year is the salary starting base that you get, and then you can win prize money at tournaments. But I think, you know, when I talk about tennis and the difficulties of tennis, obviously the fan engagement is one side of it. But on the player side, the word that just will forever keep coming out is stability. And how do we bring some of that stability to tennis players? How do we make sure that they are not worried that if you get hurt, they could feed their kids, or, you know, they're having a bad year or they had a bad 2 years and they're really not playing well? You know, how do we make sure that it's okay? And, you know, the answer may have to come out and say there is no stability in tennis. You know, this is what we have to do. And, you know, where does doubles lie? Oh, okay, only 250 players are going to make a living. Like, we truly don't care about the rest. And maybe those are the conversations that need to be had so tennis can get to a place that it, you know, that 250 players are actually truly making a living and not just fake livings, you know?
I fully agree with you that we have to have those really difficult discussions. But my question in response to that in particular, okay, so there's the idea of 250 people making a living.
Sure.
Where are those people from 100 to 250? Where are they playing? Where are the people who are, and this might be the more important question, I think, big picture, where are the people from 70 to 100? How are we guaranteeing them more than 20 matches in a calendar year?
Maybe we aren't, you know, and I'm not saying 20 is that number or whatever the number may be. And I'm not saying,
yeah, right. No.
Yeah. But like, if you told me, hey, you're going to be playing 30, 35 matches this year, that may not be the worst thing for tennis. That may be easier to follow. I'm not saying, again, the tournament structure we have to go over. We don't know where those players are going to be playing necessarily. You know, if you're saying that it's only going to be these 14 events and, you know, the Challenger Tour is going to look very different, maybe this is their discussion saying, hey, we're only caring about 75 players. You know, maybe that's the discussion. Maybe that's what they're coming out with saying in their own way without actually saying it, which is tennis' favorite pastime of putting something under the table and, you know, we're decoding it in some way, shape, or form. But, you know, maybe they're saying, hey, you know, we're not going to say fuck doubles, and we're definitely not going to say, you know, we're definitely not going to have men and women competing against each other for a bigger pie. So, okay, we have 75 in the men, 75 in the women, and we have 30 doubles teams on both sides. You know, that's a lot of players. You know, when people really put that out, you know, I don't know how many players tennis is supposed to support. So maybe this is their way to say, hey, we only have room for a total of 200 players, and these are the ones that we're choosing, and we're not willing to sacrifice doubles, and we're not going to separate men and women completely. You know, we're going to work together. So, you know, I've had these conversations with people, and it's tough. You know, I speak to players that are 500, that are 750, that are 200 in the world, and I'm like, tennis doesn't care about you. Right now it has the slams that make sure that there's some weird cutoff number of 230 in the world that you're going to get some fake salary, but tennis doesn't really give a shit. So I think this is kind of their slow play of saying, yeah, look, we don't really see a future for you guys. And if you guys want to keep playing and try to fight for those 10 spots a year, so be it. But it's going to be a fucking grind. And that's, you know, you see that in F1, you know, the F2 drivers, there's, I mean, how many guys mm-hmm. come out of F3 into F2 or going, you know, driving in X, Y, and Z to make their way? I mean, it's such a small percentage. I mean, way smaller than how many tennis players are in the top 100. So, yeah, I mean, this may be the new path. And, you know, sadly, I don't know if I hate it. You know, I'm not saying, you know, the geographic region, but I'm sick of where tennis is at right now. I'm sick of the lack of connection between player and fan and how they don't understand what any tournament means and what's going on. You know, I've people here in Lake Charles that are watching Madrid. Yeah, some are obviously deeply in it, but those are real fans of the sport. You get a casual fan, one that plays is a 3-5 player. They're like, oh, that's going on. But wait, there's a tournament. One of my friends just said there's a tournament playing here in the States. Wait, okay, but that right. goes, and I can't, that can't happen anymore. So is this the answer?
Yeah, I that's the thing. And the problem I have, Noah, is that I think I'm quite nervous about the fact that we are potentially going to go from, you know, this, you and I have talked about this for the last several years, that this is, it's chaos. There's just so many events. There's, it's impossible to keep track of. I don't think there's anyone who refutes that.
Right.
I am extraordinarily nervous about going from this, what it is now, to just like, okay, now we have 14 tournaments.
I think,
and just like without like a paring down, like I think paring it down is the right way to go. I would like to see some sort of hybrid between where we are now and that. I think having the 14 plus supplementing with 250s or you know, whatever you call them at that point, 250s every other week or something along those lines. So there's one event, your top 30 or 40 might not play it. Maybe they will. They have that option. But then suddenly you have just a paring down of the calendar as opposed to just like end of how we know it into the new world. And I'm very nervous about it, especially considering at this stage, and we're not in those conversations, right? But the fact that nothing has trickled out about the plans for how their sustainability tennis wise for 70 to 100, how we don't know yet. And there's no trickling out of news of what challengers look like, where that mobility is, how are there still tournaments and matches for players who are outside of the top 30. And until I know that, I don't think I can get behind anything, because I think that's every tennis player I know, Noah, will talk to me about how important it is to have matches, how important it is to have actual matches on court at the highest level. And without that idea for somebody outside of the top 50, I just don't know I can get behind it.
I mean, you're in the worst position to speak about this because you've watched tennis players, some, I mean, very few quicker than others, you know, those are the top of the top, but yep. Go through the Challenger Tour, play those, be a part of that, find their way and be that yes. story for that week or month or year. And that for us, you and I, and a lot of people that we know is the beauty of tennis, you know, is what
yep.
tennis so amazing. What I will say, and we spoke about this during COVID a lot, heavy on this, was I think the idea of geographic regions.
Yep.
For 100%. The majority. So let's figure out a way to have, okay, you want the 14, if that's your number, so be it. I think it could actually be less if we do it in this kind of category, but you're playing within your geographic region. And then from there, each region gets a percentage of spots based on how many players are in part of that region. And then you get to go to the Masters. And if you're not in that number, you at least have matches in your region. You get to play there. You're not traveling yep. around the world, you know, which I get is a beautiful thing. It's amazing. But let's be honest, players are tired of it. It's expensive and it's a lot of work. So how do we make sure that if you're an American that's 175 in the world, you're playing here in the States. This is maybe North America. You're playing in this area. You get to be here. And if you make a run, you get to be one of the eight American or North American players that go play the Slams and Masters 1000s. I think, you know, we spoke about this just because of how difficult the travel was during COVID, but now it's exhausting. I mean, I'm watching these players do the travel and going back and forth. And honestly, when I got back to it, you know, in January, I was like, it's great and all, but like, holy shit, this sucks. You know, like I love being around people and meeting people, but yeah, the travel is just exhausting and I'm spending so much money on it. And it was like, what are we getting out of it? So, you know, not only will this create kind of a national feel, which I think is really great for fans across the world, whatever country they're supporting, they get to really support, you know, those Americans or those Italians or Australians. But, you know, I also think it makes it much easier on the players. So I do in my heart of hearts believe that if we are getting to this 14 tournament thing, that it's really kind of a fuck you for the rest of the tennis. And I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing, but I don't think there is a manageable way to make sure that the same amount of players are making the same living. So
yeah, I get it.
I don't have an answer to that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, like I said, I'm going to reserve my judgment until I hear what the plan is for outside of those 14. I'm not opposed to it either, Noah. I'm really not, even though I might sound like it. I just, there has to be some sort of forethought for what the rest of it looks like, because ultimately, and you and I will agree on this, there has to be a path. There has to be a path, because
then it just snowball of tennis as a whole. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, there's not necessarily, listen, you and I both know Victor Estrella Burgos winning his first ATP title at 32 is the outlier, right? But you know, even Chris Eubanks is an outlier to get to that point at 26, 27.
Right.
But there needs to be I have to see this idea of what the path is for a 16, 17, 18-year-old, a 22-year-old out of college. What is their path to get to those 14 tournaments? What does that look like? And until that is structured, I have real questions about what we're doing. And I think that's where I'm going to stand.
Yeah. I think the last thing I'll say is I just want them to say something and say something real. Mm. You know, I think that's
the
point that we're at. I mean, you know, obviously we get the emails as players, and if it's a fuck you, if it's this is the plan, I just want them to stand on something and just say, yes, hey, we put in 6 months of whiteboarding and meetings and X, Y, and Z, and this is what we think is the best play, and we're going to, guns blazing, we're going to do this. I can respect that a little bit. Excuse me, a little bit, but like, I need that. I think players need that at this point. I think fans need that. The wishy-washy, the find a picture here, the find a letter here, tired of that shit. And I think tennis deserves a whole lot better, and it finds a way, you know, people still manage to be excited about Nadal coming back and, you know, playing Madrid and all of that. And that's always going to be there. But, you know, and I think some of the qualms about that generation leaving and what this generation looks like, I think tennis is in pretty good hands for the most part. But
agreed.
Don't give them the right platform. If you don't make it easy to follow and fun to be a part of, tennis will always be kind of in this bubble that it doesn't deserve to be in. So we'll see.
All right, let's hit some hot topics here. Since you and I haven't had a podcast, we've got one coming up next week with Tristan Boyer.
Yep.
And I believe the week after that, we'll have the big man himself, Marcus Willis. So that will be, we still haven't recorded that one, but that is going to be a podcast. Miami, I just, Danielle Collins, what she's doing, she still hasn't lost as of the time of recording right now. What she was able to do winning Miami, then winning Charleston, and I know she's, there is something to be said, Noah, and you can speak to it more as a player, for playing with freedom. That ability to just like, there's the end, the finish line is right over there. I have nothing to worry about anymore. I can just play and God bless her. She is kicking ass and it's awesome to watch.
If, you know, I would say, I don't even know what the number would be. Maybe 75% of players usually end on an injury. You know, that kind of
seems
to be. But if you're part of that 25% that just sees the end mentally, not feeling it, and, you know, you get that glimpse. I mean, honestly, I always go back to this one. I don't even know if it's true. I don't think he was necessarily thinking, but I played kind of Rajiv Ram towards the end of his career.
And he singles career, yes.
Singles career, yeah, yeah, of course. Singles career. And, like, he kind of settled into what his game of tennis was at that point and just, like, didn't care what he looked like, didn't care how it felt. And he, like, for that year or two, he just didn't lose before, like, the quarters of an ATP event. And you could just see there was, you know, the break point wasn't a break point for him, or the game point wasn't a good, it just was a point, and he was there, and he would look over to his base and just, like, he was just on a tennis court, you know, and there's something to be said for that. And Danielle, as you know, people that don't know her or do know her can attest, she is definitely one of a kind. And to put that, you know, I guess some mental stability in there, and to put some excitement and freedom, like you said, I mean, she has the tennis game, but to see this is definitely another level.
Yeah. You mentioned it, Rafa coming back this week. Beating Demon a couple days ago. I know, I think he plays again here in a little bit from the time of our recording, if memory serves, but man, I am a sucker for what?
Is he at the top of your French Open list right now? Is there,
man, I don't care. I don't care. Like, I just fuck, man. Like, I am a sucker for the, you know, older generation having that big push and, you know, clearly not able to go full season. Fuck, man, do your thing. Have a fucking blast. You know, hopefully he can play with some freedom. No, he's not at the top of my French Open list because I, like, how does the body hold up over 2 weeks? Nobody knows.
And I hate to be a cynic.
But fuck, doing the fucking, like, chainsaw fist pump the other day. I wanted to, like, go out there and just fucking rip somebody's head off. I was so pumped.
Yeah, you got to shoot that right into the veins. I hate bringing it to a negative, but I just have to ask you on camera. Does the next generation have a player that can do that to us? I don't know yet. We already missed a generation and it didn't give it to us. Like the Berrettini Dominic team, like that didn't get anywhere near the Djokovic Fed.
Noah, give well, listen, rivalry is one thing. So that's kind of what we talked about. Like Carlos Alcaraz gives you that. Iga gives you that. So Arena gives you that. Coco gives you that.
In 15 years, you feel this, what you're feeling to Nadal, that Nadal reaction, you're feeling that to an Alcaraz?
Why not? I mean, you never know how a person's career is going to, you know, like, who's to tell?
But it's even less, obviously, Nadal's Nadal. So it had to get there to feel part of that. But I'm still not sold. I think that's kind of what I'm getting out to. I just don't know if there's going to be. I'm separating men's and women's side right now because I do think on the women's side there could potentially be more of that feeling on the women's side, but the men, like Jannik Sinner in 15.
It feels now. It feels to me like what you're saying, and without trying to put words in your mouth, is you need, like the off court is one thing. But you need somebody or something on court where it looks like they hate each other. And there is just that incredible fire of just like, I'm going to fuck that guy up. I don't give a shit about anything else, but I'm going to fuck him up. And like, because I don't think you get that necessarily from Carlos and Jannik, right? Which is the best rivalry we have on the men's side right now. They're like very chummy and like smiley, and you don't have.
That may, I mean, there's a.
That accurate?
Yeah, I didn't even think about it. There may potentially be that aspect where it's like too friendly. I wasn't really even necessarily on the rivalry side. It's just an Alcaraz. I mean, the athleticism, we could talk about it for a day. I mean, it's insane what he can do on a tennis court.
Yeah.
I'm just, is it just of what Nadal has accomplished? Is that really what I'm getting at? Is just because he's accomplished so much and we've watched him just dominate and compete like that? Like, I think, yeah.
Well, you and I both like competitors. Yeah. Like, that's why we just talk about Danielle Collins.
Right.
Like, that's why, like, as a player, as a fan, I'm drawn to her because, like, I know she's going to give that to you every time. Same thing from Coco. Like she gives me that. And Carlos does give me that in a match. Like, when he gives you that big vamos, like, he's just looking at his team. They give me that. It's just, it's hard to project that over 15. It doesn't project over 15 years. Right. It's not something I don't think you and I could have said that when we were watching, having this discussion with Rafa at the age of 20, we'd be like, this punk kid, he's trying to mess with Roger.
Yeah. I would love to talk to somebody that was, you know, broadcasting around that time to say, did you look at Nadal at 17? I mean, I guess, you know, he won a slam around that time, but did you look at him and say, this is a guy that we're going to be really upset about when he leaves. You know, we're going to like, and that's what I would love. Like Serena, you love, hey, whatever your emotions are. Like when she roars on court, you're like, fucking something's happening on this tennis court. And I have to watch, you know, I have to be there. And I think a Coco can bring that. I think there are players on the women's side that have that, but you know, Carlos Lazao's, you know, come on and every fucking blood vessel's popping out like it's a show. But I don't know. You know, can we predict in 10 years that we're going to be, thank God Alcaraz played another event, put another year out for us because we need that. I don't know. I mean, curious.
Yeah. I totally understand what you're saying. Personal wise, anything from you? I mean, you obviously had a great time on the honeymoon. Where are you at tennis wise?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I was probably going to save this for another pod. Not feeling great right now. The wrist is pretty banged up. You know, going to have a couple doctor's appointments. Texted Klon because it happened. So I broke my wrist at the Houston ATP. I beat Klon to qualify. And we talked about it. I think you had match points. Why couldn't you put one of these fucking forehands away? So I didn't have to go play kicker, fall on my wrist and break it. He's like, yeah, I definitely had one ripped forehand that I probably just took it wide by 3 feet.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's potentially like a surgery needing situation that I don't know if mentally I have the capabilities to go through the rehab right now of it. But going to go through a couple doctor's appointments. Thought the R&R of the honeymoon would do it. I kind of felt it. Tournament before, but honestly, I mean, I'm lacking motivation here and there at times, not feeling, you know, for the 5'9" Jew that needs to put in a really good effort each and every match, not sure it's there right now, especially with the wrist that can't come over a forehand, but enjoying being here, talking about, you know, kind of having the connection to the fans closer to that. It's fun being at some of these events, so we'll be updating next few weeks. I know you spoke about Little Rock, Tyler, that's on the horizon right now for you, right? You're doing both of those? Yeah,
Little Rock and Tyler in about 4 weeks. Sarasota and Tallahassee were fine. This is going to sound really harsh. Clay court season is my least favorite season.
American clay court season, is that what you're specifying, or
no? I'm going big picture here.
Big picture, wow.
Great tennis is great tennis, and doesn't matter the surface, in my opinion. Okay,
keep going.
So, I know I'm gonna get there. So, great tennis is great tennis. Doesn't matter what surface, and it doesn't matter what level. If there's some great tennis matches on clay, always, no matter Masters, Challengers, Futures, you're going to see some great tennis matches from people who execute well on hard court, on grass, on clay.
Okay.
In my opinion, sir.
Here we are.
Bad clay court tennis is significantly worse than bad grass and bad hard courts. Significantly worse. The drop off from average to bad is way bigger on clay. Way bigger.
Can you go to the point that because surfaces are now equalizing that like now bad hard court tennis is starting to look a little bit like bad clay court tennis at times because it's so slow.
But
still.
No, because it's the movement component of somebody who sucks on clay and they're just like they'll hit six shots out of 10 in a point that are just like they're in their contact point should be here and they have to hit it here because they're just not. And so it just that's why bad clay is the worst.
Like a, and from so a like purist point of view.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So like obviously in Sarasota, Tallahassee, some great matches like the fine actually Mitch versus Zizou in Sarasota, Mitchell Kruger and Zizou Biggs. Probably the best match that we had in over those 2 weeks. It was a really high level match.
Sure.
But then, man, every once in a while, you just get one where you're just sitting there. It's like, I do not want to be here watching this right now. This is not. Oh boy.
You get obviously these players are getting taller by the fucking day. So you're getting like some of these 6'4" guys that really don't. You know, they look like giraffe on skates at times, and they're not. Yeah. So I can understand that. Yes, you're kind of dicing forehands because you're out of position, and then you get stuck on a backhand, and then it's like I should come into net because I shouldn't be here now. So they're like kind of like rolling to tennis. Like, whoa, okay, what did we do?
And full disclosure that is absolutely coming from an American standpoint. Like fully accept that component of it as well. But
I mean, I would love to get a point of view from an Argentine or a Spaniard saying like, how many times are you going to watch an inside out forehand exchange from 10 feet behind the baseline? Like how many times can you watch that point until you're like, I don't want to watch this anymore, you know? Yeah. And, you know, okay, here we go. Let me just go to my second serve because I don't need to serve. We're just going to kick a serve out wide. He's going to run around the rope before, and I'm going to go back in deep. And now we're in a point for 10 minutes. And that is every single point there. That's not fun. That's not that fun. I don't know. So I don't want to get into the surface discussion, but
yeah, because listen, you give me Rafa on clay. I'm going to fucking watch that every second of it.
Yeah. That guy eats clay. That guy eats the clay.
Iga on clay. God.
Yeah.
I mean,
she looks like a fucking ballerina on clay though.
Yes.
I mean, these are people that are built for it, and then you get the ones that aren't, or the mid South American Spanish clay quarter. I'm like, yeah, this is cool and all, but like, I don't know, man. 3 out of 5 sets of this, like, I just, and we gotta stop making hard court slow. That's just the end.
I agree. especially if we do go down to 14 tournaments.
Yeah,
that will drastically need to happen. That being said, I'm actually in like I'm in a really good place right now, Noah. Like I'm happy. I'm content, man. I had a great time at your wedding. Like there have been some things that have happened in my family lately that have just been really hard. But I'm starting to do a better job right now of like approaching everything with gratitude and appreciation and you know, I appreciate having this time to chat it up with you and talk some shit and, you know, get these tennis opinions out of my brain and then put them into the ether and then never think about them again.
Not never. yeah, I feel like the last few podcasts we have said that you've been in the best place. I actually think it's correlating to you not being quite as mean to me, which some people actually dislike. So if you can bring that back.
I can. Listen, man.
Let's do a shout out. Max Eichler's speech at my wedding, pretty damn good. So obviously, most of the people listening to this will not be going to my wedding or not have watched it. But one of my closest friends, he did the wedding at my. Oh, sorry, he did the speech at my wedding, and he just roasted me. One line being, "Would I like to be at Tiafoe's wedding? Sure. Taylor Fritz's, 100%." But here I am at the pickleball champion. And it was pretty good. And I think people have come up to me, Mike, and they said, you're just being a little too nice to me, you know, recently. And
I'm sorry. You are a very little person. Your wrists are weak because your heart is weak. I don't know. I don't,
I didn't.
I'm not really.
I'm
not feeling it right now, even though I'm a little under the weather and like I've been woken up by thunderstorms all night, but I'm in a good place and you're going to be the beneficiary by me telling you I love you. Oh, so there you go.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. Well, it was a pleasure to have you there. I'm glad that you managed to come spend some time with us. It was it was a good time. And
yes, it was.
Now I get to say wife to you.
I'm sorry, to me?
To you. You're my wife.
Okay. I'm your work wife. That's
my
fine.
Work wife.
Oh, I'll accept that. I'll accept that. Again, Tristan Boyer on the podcast next week, and we'll talk to you then.
The show might be over, but the conversation isn't. Join us on social media at NoahRubin33, at Mike C. Tennis, and at Behind the Racket.
Expect new episodes every Monday or Tuesday. And don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. It really helps us expand and reach more listeners as we take you behind the racket.